Welcome to Breitbart News Daily. Lots of guests today. Rob Henderson, one of my favorite people, amazing writer, has a new book called Troubled. He grew up in foster care, went to the Air Force Academy, then Yale Law School and Cambridge, and can speak to the elites and how horrible they are. So he was great. We talked to Vance Ginn, who was Trump's chief economist in the Office of Management and Budget. And so he had some great insight. We talked about Biden's budget and compared it to Trump's budget, et cetera. We talked to Bernie Moreno, candidate for Senate in Ohio right now. There's three Republicans running for Senate in Ohio. The vote is tomorrow. And Bernie was last, just a couple months ago, third. And now he's shot to the top and got the Trump endorsement and big rally on Saturday with him. So we talked to him at 7 o'clock. So that's going to be on Breitbart.com, that interview. So for here on this podcast, we'll play for you our chat with Josh Hammer from America on Trial about the latest with the Georgia RICO trial and all this ridiculousness happening there. It's just beautiful to watch the whole thing crumble before our eyes. I love it. So we'll play that in just a minute. But first, speaking of the rally, speaking of Bernie Moreno, there was a rally on Saturday where Trump said there will be a bloodbath if he doesn't win and the left is going nuts. And it's wonderful to watch as well. We'll debunk that right here. Thanks for being here. All right, let's do this this bloodbath thing. So it's great. It's going to be like this for next 7-8 months. It's going to be like this for the next 4 more years after that. NBC News headline. Trump says there will be a bloodbath if he loses the election. CBS in Ohio rally. And by the way, coming up again at 7, we're going to talk to the reason he was at the Ohio rally, Bernie Moreno, who's running for Senate in Ohio. In Ohio rally, Trump says there will be a bloodbath if he loses. Rolling Stone, Trump says there will be a bloodbath. You get it? It's going to be a bloodbath. And the left, of course, loved it. The insinuation is that if Trump loses, then there will be J6ers on the streets everywhere burning down buildings and committing, say, I don't know, $2 billion worth of damage across the country. You know all the damage that they caused to the Capitol building. Couple broken windows. Do we have a number on how much damage was caused at the Capitol building? How many windows were broken? I know Nancy Pelosi's office, they broke a mirror. Sorry, I get choked up whenever I think about that mirror. Okay, sorry. So it'll be a bloodbath of all those J6ers all over the country unleashed. It'll be like in Haiti. You know, in Haiti, the guy barbecue, he liberated prisons. he went across and freed the prisoners. Like in Batman, they happened in Batman, didn't it? And that's what Trump's going to do. He's going to liberate the prisons. It's going to be a bloodbath if he loses. And so, of course, they ran with it because they're liars. They lie. And they know they lie. Here's a red flag. Something to keep an eye out for. If you ever see a headline or a quote in an article where they only put the quotation marks around a single word or a few words, then you know they're lying. So the headlines here, it says, NBC News, Trump says there will be a, and then in quote, bloodbath, end quote, if he loses the election. Obviously, they picked a single word. Just a single word out of a quote and ran with it. And then they will put their own context around it. And the text will say something like, Donald Trump yesterday at a rally said there will be a, quote, bloodbath if he's, quote, not elected in November. Right? And that's it. And they take the before and after, everything around it. And you just think, why are you not quoting the entire sentence? Still, articles will not do this. Article Breitbart, Matt Boyle has a bunch of great articles. And one just I read this morning that he takes the whole paragraph. Why does the New York Times, I never see these mainstream outlets, lamestream outlets, take a paragraph. Just take a paragraph and quote the whole thing that the person says. They never do it. Ever. Don't know why they're against doing it. Why? Of course we know why. So this shows that they're lying on purpose. They're intentionally removing the portions that provide context. And if they do that, then they don't have an article. So here's the full minute of what Trump said.
Mexico has taken over a period of 30 years, 34% of the automobile manufacturing business in our country. Think of it. Went to Mexico. China now is building a couple of massive plants where they're going to build the cars in Mexico and think that they're going to sell those cars into the United States with no tax at the border. Let me tell you something to China. If you're listening, President Xi, and you and I are friends, but he understands the way I deal, those big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now, and you think you're going to get that, you're going to not hire Americans, and you're going to sell the cars to us now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. They're building massive factories. A friend of mine.
He goes on. Right now, as we speak, Webster's Dictionary, the third definition of the word bloodbath is, quote, a major economic disaster. I look forward to them changing that definition, which they did a lot of the last few years. They often change the definition of words, Webster's, the new Webster. That's why the only dictionary I use is Webster's 1828.com. It's the original dictionary, and it's awesome. You can't even trust the dictionary anymore. So it's a bloodbath. Obviously, the definition of bloodbath is a major economic disaster. But they're taking it as Trump is going to unleash you on the people. Here's Biden's team. Here we go. Here's on MSNBC. So they're just giving the marching orders here.
Heard was a continuation of the same rhetoric, the same endorsement of political violence that we've seen from Donald Trump for years, as you pointed out. It goes even farther back, right? This is the same guy who, after Nazis marched on Charlottesville and killed a woman, said there were very fine people on both sides. This is the same guy who, in 2020, told the Proud Boys, a white supremacist group, to stand back and stand by. And now every single day on the stump, he is championing and praising the insurrectionists who he encouraged to violently storm the Capitol in an attempt to overthrow our democracy. So it's not simply one comment. This is exactly who Donald Trump is, and this is exactly the threat that he poses to our democracy every single day. I think the problem for Trump, though, is that the American people...
So that's pretty good. If you're ever talking to anyone... Well, this isn't... There's two different people here. If you're talking to a regular person and they bring up the Charlottesville good people on both sides thing... Yeah, maybe they still don't know the truth of that. And you can politely inform them as to what really happened and what the context of that was and who he was really referring to, obviously. Because it's very obvious. Just read the transcript. You can play the clip. And then it's actually a really fun moment if you can do that to someone. If you can find someone still who genuinely believes that Trump called the Nazis fine people in Charlottesville, and you could play for them the full clip of what Trump said, if they're an honest person, then you can watch everything crumble in front of them. Like their whole, like all their trust in the media just disintegrate in front of your eyes. And it's pretty fun to see. So you can give them a chance if you interact with a normal, regular person. But if you ever hear anyone on the TV, like this guy, talking about Charlottesville, you know he's lying. He knows he's lying. Everyone there involved knows that they're lying. But when, if you bring up Charlottesville, you're just a liar. We got some polls here. Time heals all wounds. USA Today. Biden approval rating, 41% approve, 55% disapprove. It's actually pretty high, 41% approval for Biden. Harris, Judge Kamala Harris, job approval, 36% approve, 52% disapprove. I don't think we're going to get to it today, but the Washington Post wrote an article about how Kamala Harris got to go. That's a dead weight. But here's a good question. The job Donald Trump did as president. So the other poll, how's Biden doing? This one is how did Donald Trump, how did he do? Do you approve of the job he did as president? We got 49% approval, 47% disapproval. So he is in the positive. So you got more people looking back and saying, you know what? I actually did a pretty good job. Now that I think about it. NBC News quoting, let's see, three of their reporters. They had a White House had a meeting about Michigan and Georgia, different polls in battleground states. President Joe Biden was seething, NBC News says. In a private meeting with the White House, allies of the president had just told, oh, this is in January. This is about a meeting that was in January. This is new news, but about a meeting that was in January. Allies of the president just told him that his poll numbers in Michigan and Georgia had dropped over his handling of the war between Israel and Hamas. Both are battleground states he narrowly won 4 years ago. He can't afford any backsliding if he's once again going to defeat Donald Trump. He began to shout and swear, a lawmaker familiar with the meeting said. He believed what he was doing was right despite the political fallout, he told the group, according to the lawmaker. So he is, they're in freak-out mode. And imagine these people when they get desperate. Ohio is no longer a swing state. Again, we'll talk to the Senate candidate, or one of the Senate candidates coming up here, the Trump-endorsed one, coming up in just a few minutes. Florida is not a swing state either anymore. Trump's up by six. Florida is a red state. But check this out. This is voters 18 to 29. Young people. Trump leads Biden. Let's stop there. 18 to 29, Trump, the Republican leads the Democrat? At all. Let alone by 18 points. Amazing. Now, whenever I share polls, take it all with a grain of salt. If for no other reason, even if the polling is accurate to a T, even if the polling is a perfectly precise, like magically precise measurement of people's sentiment and voting are two completely different things. We could have, just to be comical about it, 80% of people could support Donald Trump and 20% support Biden. But if only Biden supporters show up, Biden wins 100% of the vote. You with me? So, sentiment's fine, great, but it's about voting. And then it's about who's counting the votes, obviously. I'll give you one more poll. And then we'll do a little lead into our guest coming up in just a minute. It's a poll about voting ID, showing a photo ID for voting. I have not come across an issue that is more overwhelmingly supported than this. 82% of men, 78% of women support showing an ID to vote. 82%. And it doesn't, young, old, kids, no kids, white, not white, doesn't matter. It's actually 77% white, 85% non-white. So Black and Hispanic people, by a higher percentage, support showing a photo ID. The group that is most against showing a photo ID are white college-educated people. And even then, only 33% don't support it. 65% still support. Even among the most progressive, wacky, white, liberal women, 65% still support showing a photo ID. If you get anything that 65% of people support, then that's an overwhelming support. And that's the worst demographic with the lowest support. Among Black and Hispanic people, it's 85% support. Republicans need to go so hard on this. Like make this the defining characteristic of the Republican Party, because there's nothing that polls this well. This is an absolute no-brainer for every reason and massively supported. I can't think of anything else that is supported by this many people showing a photo ID to vote. Why are they not? Why? This is such a good example of how Republicans are the worst. Could you possibly be hesitant about this, Republicans in office? There's no, like, even Republicans today in office are like, I don't want to touch that one. What are you talking about? There's nothing that is more supported than this. I'll end with Eric Holder. Eric Holder. You believe that? It's like, whoa, wait a second. He was asked about the polls that are so bad. He said, it's March. November's a long way away. Don't worry. Everyone will come back home, is what he says. And he said, everyone will come back as the media turns its attention to making this a binary choice between a person who's got some age and cognitive issues. That would be Trump against somebody who's actually accomplished a lot. I think we'll do just fine. How about that? So they're going to try to make age and cognitive issues. They're going to try to pin that on the younger, healthier person, which is a risky play because it's not true. And they're even just bringing it up. The fact that they're even bringing those words up, I think, reminds people of what is obviously true. And that is about Joe. So it's a risky play to even bring up the words cognitive issues because obviously people's initial reaction is going to go to Biden. But that's one of their plays too, which is just fine by me. Go right to Josh Hammer from the First TV's podcast, America on Trial. What's going on, Josh?
Mike, my friend, how are you, brother?
Good to talk to you. Thanks for getting up early for us on this Monday. So let's go back to the beginning of the Georgia RICO charges against Trump, because this one had the biggest fanfare of like, oh, it's 18 people, it's massive, it's huge, this is the one that's going to get them, all the rest. So take us back to the beginning. What were the initial charges of this case?
Yeah, so the Georgia prosecution, Mike, this is the one that last year when it dropped, and if memory serves, it was the fourth of all four of the prosecutions to drop. I think that the charges were finally released last August after almost 2 years of Fannie Willis doing this investigation. She launched this thing way back in November of 2021. Back when this dropped, this was the one that struck many of us as potentially being the one that could actually really trip up Donald Trump. And that was the case for numerous reasons. One is the fact that this is involving state law, not federal law. So even if Trump were to win the presidency, he would not be able to pardon himself. The president can only pardon himself hypothetically, it's never happened before, but you hypothetically can only pardon yourself for federal crimes, not state crimes. Furthermore, you're dealing with a very blue jurisdiction in Fulton County, Georgia. That's where the city of Atlanta is. That's a roughly 80-20, I think maybe even technically 83-17 Joe Biden over Donald Trump voting county. So
depends how many water mains are working or not. But yeah, sure, totally. 80-20, I'll go with you.
Yeah, something along those lines, right? You also have a very very wide-ranging RICO statute. So that's the actual statute that Fannie Willis and the prosecutors there whipped out to indict Donald Trump and his roughly 18 or so co-defendants in this case. They did so under Georgia's mini RICO statute, and it's modeled on the federal congressional RICO statute. And you know, Mike, just to make sure we're all on the same page here, RICO at the federal level, at a U.S. Congress level, developed decades ago in the 20th century as a congressional response to the rise of La Cosa Nostra, to the rise of organized crime and the old school Sicilian mafia in America. That is literally the implicit analogy that Georgia prosecutors are making here. And it's an absolutely absurd and outright offensive analogy that should sit deeply uncomfortably with most Americans, the idea that you have a local prosecutor charging a former president with essentially being the equivalent of a Don Corleone mob boss orchestrating a grand conspiracy to overturn an election in this case in the state of Georgia. But again, the fact that the RICO statute in Georgia is written in such broad language many of us were concerned that this could allow Fannie Willis and her team to really kind of run the gamut, so to speak, when it comes to Donald Trump. Now, the other problem, of course, is in Georgia. You have a Republican governor, Brian Kemp, and a Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who have had their issues with Donald Trump. So many of us are worried that they could potentially be called as hostile witnesses in this case. So it really had the makings of something, Mike, the point I'm making. It had the makings of something that really could trip up Donald Trump. But for the past 2 months now, we've been embroiled in this Hollywood-esque soap opera saga of Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade. And it's really distracted. I think a lot of the momentum that Fannie Willis and her prosecutors were working up towards building. And then we had the ruling finally on Friday as to whether or not she would be disqualified. And it's a peculiar ruling. It's a peculiar decision from Judge Scott McAfee. Based on how Fannie Willis conducted herself at that evidentiary hearing a few weeks ago that we all saw, when she frankly just looked like an unhinged and, if we're just being very blunt, like somewhat of a stupid person. I mean, she just didn't comport herself with any kind of, any kind of public decency. She seemed very frantic. She was yelling. She was asking, like, what continent is the country of Belize in? I mean, she just didn't come across as a particularly competent person who was entrusted with the public law enforcement prosecutorial function. And I thought that McAfee, the judge there, was leaning towards a disqualification. But in the ruling on Friday, he used very harsh language. He says that there is a, quote, odor of mendacity, an odor of lying and untruthfulness that lingers over this whole case when it comes to her affair with the special prosecutor that she hired, Nathan Wade. And he then says that there is an appearance of corruption, an appearance of impropriety here. But he fails then to do the natural thing that I think he should have done upon making that finding and just disqualify her. Instead, he required that one of the two of them step aside. And Nathan Wade was the one who resigned Friday afternoon. Now, Trump's going to have his shot on appeal here. He's going to be able to appeal this to the appellate court, to Scott McAfee's superior court, the Georgia Court of Appeals at the state level there. They're probably going to be able to rule as to whether the remedy here was improper, which is fancy legalese for saying there's still a shot that Fannie Willis gets disqualified here. At a bare minimum, at the end of the day, this thing just gets delayed and delayed, and it's continually delayed more and more. So from a strict timeline perspective, I think that Trump is still looking pretty good there in Georgia right now.
Okay. All right. Let's one more point on the conclusion of it. Also, if nothing else, this is all that anyone's talking about with it. And no one's talking about the merits of their case, whatever merits there happen to have been even in the beginning, right?
Yeah. I mean, this really has become the Georgia case. I mean, when people talk about the Georgia case right now, you're thinking about Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade.
Yeah.
I mean, look, Mike, I'm a lawyer. I mean, I watch this stuff a lot. That hearing we saw a few weeks ago was nuts. I mean, Fannie Willis, I couldn't take my eyes off my television watching the way that she was behaving herself. She apparently ran to that courtroom in a haste because she was so eager. She was so huffing and puffing to get up there to try to defend her reputation. But honestly, whoever told her to get up there on the witness stand, I think made a mistake, because she did not do herself any favor. And the other silver lining that comes out of this for Trump, Mike, is that even if Fannie Willis stays on this case, and even if they somehow are able to expedite a trial and get a verdict in before November, which I don't think they will, but even if they will do that at this point, I think Fannie has conducted herself in such shameful and disgraceful fashion that a jury pool, even in far left Fulton County, Georgia, is going to be pretty far-fetched to issue a unanimous criminal conviction at this point, given the way Fannie has acted.
Let's go back half a step. Just want to make sure we're on the same page in case we need to articulate this to someone who's not paying attention like we are. So you have Fannie Willis, who's the DA of Fulton County, Georgia. She's the one bringing the charges. She hired Nathan Wade as a special prosecutor. Is that right? And they had relations together.
Correct. So because this involves a special type of prosecution, again, it's Georgia's RICO statute. This is not a typical prosecution, right? It's not like every day a county DA office is going to indict a former president of the United States on a statute that resembles something that you'd use to go against the Gambino crime family. So it's not this is not a typical prosecution by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, Fonnie Willis, with all due respect, doesn't really kind of come across as a top-tier Supreme Court advocate-level attorney. So she basically needs to hire a specialist. I mean, that's essentially what this boils down to.
Okay.
And it turned out that the man that she hired to be a specialist, to be the actual lawyer with knowledge of bringing RICO cases, was someone who she had been in an affair with. And then the question was, what was the timeline of this affair? Did the affair commence before or after she formally hired him as part of this investigation? And then that's been a lot of the back and forth for the past 2 months, is were they sleeping together before she hired him, after? But the details of the timeline to me, Mike, were always a little bit of a distraction. The point is that there is a clear, clear appearance of corruption and impropriety here. And again, Judge Scott McAfee used very withering language in his decision on Friday. He just didn't ultimately pull the trigger the way many of us thought he should.
Okay, sorry, I got to pull up this Instagram video from Trump about this. This is Nathan Wade.
Willis, ever.
Oh, let me go back. Pull it up. Here we go. Oh, you got it?
Miss Willis.
Oh, darn it. Instagram's annoying because it starts to play, but then you got to press the volume button so it doesn't pop up right away. It's very annoying. Here it is.
You go to a cabin with Miss Willis ever.
Ever?
Ever.
Okay, and he's doing a thought bubble of Fonnie Willis scantily clad. He's contemplating. But what a bizarre question. Did you ever go to a cabin ever with Fonnie Willis? And he says, ever? did I ever? So how did they get on a stand? Why were they even put on a stand at all? Like, what was the accusations against them that's like was like stand worthy? Do you know what I mean?
Right. So what happened was in mid-January, as this thing was going through the suite of pretrial motions, because these things take time. Like, in criminal prosecutions take a lot of time. There's always a ton of pretrial motions, and the defense needs discovery. So as part of the routine suite of pretrial motions that any criminal prosecution has, one of Trump's many co-defendants in this case, and he has a bunch of co-defendants in the Georgia case. He has John Eastman. He has Jeffrey Clark. He has Mark Meadows, his former chief of staff, Jenna Ellis, my friend and fellow commentator. And one of the co-defendants is a Republican operative by the name of Michael Roman, who somehow found himself involved in the Georgia election in XYZ capacity, and Fonnie Willis decided to indict him. And it was Michael Roman's lawyers who filed this motion in mid-January, where I guess they did the work that no one else had done so far, where they kind of just, you know, hired an investigator, or they searched deep in the bowels of their Google archive, and they somehow managed to piece together that Fonnie Willis and Nathan Wade had been romantically involved.
Whoa.
And they filed the formal motion to disqualify Fonnie Willis and Nathan Wade because of this affair and because of their corruption. And upon looking at the initial evidence of it, Judge McAfee said, you know what, like, there's actually something here. We're going to have a hearing to kind of tease this all out.
And that's how interesting. Wow. So it wasn't even Trump's lawyers who unearthed this and got the ball moving forward in this.
Yeah, it was Michael Roman. And, you know, a lot of them are sharing lawyers, but it was actually Michael Roman's lawyers in this case.
Wow. Very good. Okay. My last question for you. What about the other 18 people? Have they done anything? Have they pled guilty or anything, or are they just waiting, just like Trump is?
So, it's a mixed bag. So Jenna Ellis has taken a plea deal. She took a plea deal a few months ago, so she's essentially off the hook for all intents and purposes, not going to end up serving any jail time or anything like that, not going to have to face trial. Mark Meadows has tried multiple times thus far, both times unsuccessfully, to move his particular prosecution from court to federal court. The argument there is that his actions as pertains to Kemp and Raffensperger and the 2020 election in Georgia, the argument there is that Mark Meadows was acting in his official capacity as White House chief of staff, and that when you're acting as a federal official, you must be tried in federal court. thus far, federal
court. Yeah, that makes sense. I can't believe that didn't work. Josh, I should have given you a warning. We got to hit the break here. I apologize. But please, everyone, if you want more, and who doesn't, go to America on Trial. Search that podcast on the First TV, America on Trial with Josh Hammer. Josh, thanks, man. Thanks for clarifying this for us. Appreciate your insight.
You bet. Anytime.
I mean, America on Trial is the name of the podcast to follow all of these. And this one is the most fun because it's just, I mean, it's what it is. You build a house of cards like this. It's going to come crumbling down. But for it to come crumbling down so quickly, it's beautiful to see. I'm American made. Welcome back to Breitbart News Daily. Thanks for listening. Talking to Bernie Moreno today about Senate in Ohio just brought up a lot of stuff about the Rust Belt and towns that we need to chat more about and tariffs and all that. So we'll do much more of that talk tomorrow. Mike Slater, Breitbart News Daily. Spread the word.